Good afternoon and welcome to Time Out, your program of informative interviews with persons of note, persons with fascinating careers, leaders of today and tomorrow, and others who will allow you to invest an hour and receive a guaranteed valuable return. So stay tuned. It's cold and clammy and dark here in Carrboro, North Carolina, but this radio show will not be cold and clammy. It'll be very exciting and interesting because we're welcoming again on our first show of the year, Professor Dr. Connell Fuhlenkamp. That's a long title, isn't it, Connie?
Boy, it sure is.
We call him Connie.
Most people do.
Professor Fuhlenkamp is a professor of the practice of economics at Duke University and a director of undergraduate studies. He's been at Duke for a while. Let's hear you tell us where you've been until we get into the conversation of economics.
Sure. Well, this year has been kind of a fun year. I was traveling a bit. In addition to working at Duke as a professor, I also do some consulting for the International Monetary Fund. And this year I've been to Brazil and Vienna, Austria, and Singapore. Those are some usual places
I go to.
Yeah, and one of the interesting places I went to, which was new for me, was Rabat, Morocco. I got to go there for a week in late May to give a course for government officials from the Middle East about macroprudential economic policy.
Macroprudential.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, we'll talk about that on another show. not this show today.
Sure.
So before you did that, you were teaching elsewhere before you started out?
I sure was. So when I first got my PhD, I took a job on the faculty at Notre Dame in the business college there. And I was there for, eight years, and then came down to Duke in about 1999.
So you were in the business college at Notre Dame, but of course, you're in the undergraduate.
Yeah, in the economics department. At Notre Dame there, they had a Department of Finance and Business Economics, and I was kind of on the business economics but also a little bit on the finance side. So I taught economics and finance courses there, and I do the same thing at Duke.
Well, now, when people at your level of academic knowledge change jobs in different do they recruit you or do you what's the normal procedure for moving from one university to another?
The normal procedure is to be recruited. I wasn't really exactly recruited by Duke. I came down mostly because, as you know, my spouse is has a PhD in organic chemistry and she does drug discovery research. So she came down to work at Glaxo, and I was thinking about what I wanted to do next in my career. And
oh, so you got the job here before you landed, were still employed at Notre Dame.
That's right. And so she came down in the fall of, I think, 1998, and I came in the spring of 1999 and took what I thought would be a short-term teaching job at Duke.
1999?
In 1999.
Until here we are in
2017. So here we are. Yeah. So along the way, I became a professor of the practice at Duke, and it's been a really great experience. I really love what I do there. And about the same time, I started working for the International Monetary Fund. So
how did they recruit you for that?
The usual way that you get a job in real life, you know somebody. Uh-huh. I had a colleague from Notre Dame who joined the IMF, and he joined a new unit, and they were developing courses on financial economics, and they needed some outside help. And he said, I know a good guy. He called me.
Okay, well, now you're on this team that travels in these various cities you mentioned. Your team is not all American, though.
No, actually, it's quite an international bunch. There are definitely some Americans, but people from India, from South America, from Asia. So it's really great. It's a very diverse and very cosmopolitan environment at the IMF. People literally from all over the world, and so it's a really great and very fun place to work.
So have your relationships with these international fellows and men and women that you work with, do they influence you at all in some of your coursework that you might be teaching undergraduates?
Yeah, absolutely. For example, one of the big interesting international stories in economics this fall was in India, where the government decided literally overnight to invalidate the vast majority of its circulating currency.
Oh, I know, it made a big hit in the papers. Yeah,
exactly. And so one of the colleagues that I had traveled with for over 10 years was from India originally, and he had told me repeatedly in the past all these stories about the so-called black money in India, which is this currency that is basically obtained either illegally or people are hiding it from the tax man. And so there was this dual economy in India that was the white economy with the money that was going through the normal channels and was being taxed, and the so-called black money, which was a separate economy, kind of an underground economy. And so the government is trying to drive the so-called black money out of the economy in India, and it's such a big problem that they took this incredibly drastic measure, which is actually, in the short term, really hurting the economy because the Indian economy is so cash-driven. And so understanding that and having that background, I knew immediately when that story hit what it was all about and what they were trying to do. And so I found it really fascinating, and of course pass that on to my students, many of whom come from at different parts of the world, including South Asia.
So that's great. So I forget, I've been reading about that, but I haven't seen anything lately about the cash situation or the money situation in India. Has it settled down a bit?
It has a bit. The government is allowing private individuals to exchange very small amounts at a time. And so they're using that as kind of a workaround, and some of the black money is kind of still seeping into the economy. I've heard stories, for example, that rich families are paying their hired help a year in advance in cash.
Oh, really?
So that they can go and then deposit the money in the bank and then convert it from black money into white money. So but really it's kind of a waiting game. There people are complaining. Businesses are actually folding, small businesses, because with no cash circulating in a cash-driven economy, they don't have credit cards, they don't have a lot of credit, so that when the cash dries up, your business dries up.
Sure.
So that's happened in a lot of cities.
Well, is dark money a disease that is in other countries in various levels of degree, like even the United States?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the other related stories that you've seen is that in developed economies, including the European Union and even Switzerland, there are moves afoot to ban large denomination currencies like the 200 euro bill, the 1,000 Swiss franc note. And even there are some people who suggest that we should ban the $100 bill in the U.S. Because the claim is that these currencies, these denominations only exist to finance the drug trade or the human trafficking and other kinds of things that we don't want to have. Mm-hmm. If you actually look at the statistics, the vast majority of $100 bills that are produced in the U.S. actually leave the country and go to other countries, some of which, of course, goes to the underground economy, but a lot of it is also legitimate. There are certain economies out there that operate on a U.S. dollar standard, like Zimbabwe, for example, or Lebanon.
Well, so you see in movies suitcases full of $100 bills.
Yeah, exactly. That's a real thing. And actually, when you have to make a large purchase, then you really realize how many bills you actually need to make a big purchase. It turns out that the average briefcase can only hold, I don't even think it can hold $1 million in $100 bills. So
I haven't tried to fill my briefcase.
Yeah, I haven't either. But so it's not a question for me, but it is kind of interesting.
Wow. Well, we're off the track, but it's always interesting talking with you, Connie, because you do have these international contacts, which most of us don't have. And most of the economy professors probably at Duke and other universities don't have the same relative connections that you have, fortunately, through the International Monetary Fund.
Yeah, I think that's been a big advantage for me, and it's been a really big enhancement to my own kind of my research and my teaching, for sure.
Well, we're talking with Professor Connie Fullenkamp of Duke University, and we're going to get right into some world of economics. But I want to ask him, you're a pretty heavy handed teacher, I hear, from sometimes. Is that the right way to say it, or do you... Or do you approach teaching with a degree of seriousness that people can't smile at?
Well, I don't know. I have a really good time when I teach, and I think my students do, too.
You have a good time.
I think my students, when they complain about the heaviness, they're complaining about the exams that I give. For example, I gave one. I wrote my final exam for my Principles of Economics course, I sat down and was trying to think about one particular problem. I thought it was quite easy, but then when I sat down and thought about it, I thought it was actually about, when I said to my teaching assistants, it was between 10 and a million times harder than I thought it would be.
Oh, 10 and a million times. Okay. So you didn't use it.
No, I actually still used it. It was still a really good question. It was only one of about 10 different questions on the test. And so, I'll put what I think are really challenging questions on my exam. Not all of them, of course. I mean, what I want to do is have a variety of questions. Some are easy, some are kind of middle size, and some are really tough to help students help distinguish the students who really understand it from the students who understand it somewhat, but not as well. Uh-huh. And so I guess my willingness to really hang out some questions out there that I think are accessible to them, but are nonetheless pretty challenging, I think that is part of the reputation.
Well, I told you my granddaughter's roommate was in your class last year as a freshman. And,
sure.
And she told me when I had dinner with her that she was frightened to death when she started your class, but she learned how to deal with it as time went on.
Well, I think I think there's a couple of things going on. One is that, you know, I teach freshmen, and so that transition from high school to college is still a really tough transition.
That's
no matter
true.
How well you do in high school.
Yeah.
It's still very, very different in college. And the only way to get through it is to live through it and do it. And mm-hmm. so I think that's a big part of what goes on in my class. And that's part of the reason why I like to teach it in the fall, because I get students who are brand new to college, and I try to show them, you know, this is really what college is all about. You know, being presented some material and becoming an independent thinker who can take the stuff that you talk about in the classroom and apply it to the real world. I mean, that's really, to me, what college is all about. Mm-hmm. What we're trying to do at any good college is saying, here is a way that a model or a concept that we use to understand the world, and here's a bunch of stuff in the real world. So let's take A and apply it to B and see if we can make some sense out of it.
Well, I guess in economics you could probably cover a lot of areas in the real world, can't you?
Absolutely. In fact, I base my teaching off of that. So I take all of the teaching that I do is based off of Wall Street Journal articles. So
is
if
that
I
right?
want to, yeah. So if I want to illustrate some concepts, say about, you know, a production. I take examples of firms who are wrestling with real problems in their production or making decisions that affect their production. Do we produce here or there? Do we make the cheap stuff or do we make the more expensive stuff? Uh-huh. And so I take that and show them how we can apply the models to understand why the firms are making the choices that they're making. And,
that's real life activity.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, to me, that's the whole reason I got involved in economics in the first place.
I think I took a freshman course in economics in college. But I don't remember much about it. It was 70 years ago. But I don't remember any teacher going into the real life. Most professors, you're not discussing real life. You're discussing a textbook historical items or artwork.
Exactly. So, you know, I think the thing that makes the material come alive for people to say, yeah, we've got these really simple concepts, but it's amazing what you can do to take a simple model or a simple concept and say, I can use that to understand why people are actually doing what they're doing out in the real world. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's really the fun of teaching.
Now, you study monetary policy?
A bit, yes. I'm very interested in monetary policy. I study that as part of my general interest in financial markets, since monetary policy really drives interest rates.
What is monetary policy?
Well, it's really the process of controlling the supply of money and through it the level of interest rates and oftentimes also the level of inflation in the economy, since the amount of money in the economy is a big driver of inflation, though not the only thing that determines it.
Okay, but when you use the word policy, you're thinking somebody is setting a policy.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've got the Federal Reserve in Washington or a central bank.
What are the elements in this country? You mentioned Federal Reserve. So what other elements have an effect on our monetary policy, and what elements are the better drivers of it?
Well, it's really this kind of dance between the Federal Reserve, which is the monetary authority in our country, and the private banks, because the banks, of course, are through taking deposits and lending, they're actually also creating money, and so the Fed is trying to control that private process of creating money through the deposit taking and lending process. And so they're trying to apply the brakes or apply the accelerator to that process. And the banks, of course, are all out there just trying to make a profit and survive in this economy. Mm-hmm. And so that interaction is really what monetary policy is all about, and how fast the quantity of loans expands and how fast business expands or how slowly those things happen are really, you know, the measures of how our monetary policy is working.
So when the Federal Reserve bumps up the interest rate by a quarter of a percent, that affects our monetary policy.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what they're trying to do is to try to slow down the growth of the money supply and trying to at least gently slow down the pace of business so that we don't start to accelerate inflation.
Okay, so when business moves faster, inflation develops. Is that what you're saying?
Generally speaking, you know, we like to say there's this old old proverb that, you know, inflation is too much money chasing too few goods. So that if the Fed creates too much money, it gets circulated through the economy, and so people suddenly have more cash, and so they're willing to pay higher prices to get everything, and that's going to start to drive prices up.
Mm-hmm. Well, we say it says that the federal creates money. Do they create money, or is the money there in the institution of our overall economy? And when the Fed does something, is it building new money that wasn't there?
Yeah, it's literally creating money out of nothing.
Okay.
Yeah, so in the current monetary system that we have, which is called a fiat money system, because it's based on the power of fiat or command, you command something into existence out of nothing. The Federal Reserve literally has the ability to create money out of nothing. And, you know, we talk about the Fed printing money, although that's not really the process.
Well, that's the word they use,
right? It's really digits in a computer, right?
Uh-huh.
So that's if they wanted to, I guess they could run the printing presses day and night, but that's not really effective. What's more effective is to change the amount of deposits that banks have at the Fed, the so-called reserves, the high-powered money, which then the banks can take and use as the basis for lending onto businesses and individuals, and that takes place at a massive level, and that's really where the money creation happens.
Okay, but when money is created, what backs it? Anything?
Well, as we like to say, the full faith and credit of the U.S. government.
Okay.
So it's really literally not backed by anything. It's backed by really our common belief in the value of the money and our trust in the government not to really decrease the value of the money through inflation,
uh-huh.
Right? The big threat to the value of our money, the threat to the value of our purchasing power is high inflation.
Yeah.
So if the Fed promises to defend the purchasing power by not making inflation too high, then I think everybody's pretty happy to use the money.
So the last really bout of inflation we had was, 30 years ago?
Yeah, really, the last big bout of inflation was the inflation that started in the late 60s and got worse through the 70s and really didn't subside until the early to mid-80s.
Yeah.
That was really the big period of inflation, although if you go back to right before the financial crisis, inflation was also then starting to creep up a bit then.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But so during that period, which you're talking about, historical inflation, what was happening with our lifestyle in that during that time? Was it affecting people's ability to purchase things? Was it affecting the manufacturing level that was lower, or what was?
Well, it's kind of interesting because for a while the economy was really the extra money was really firing up the economy and stimulating it, right? But then the problem, of course, is that eventually the prices start to rise faster than the rest of the economy does, and the prices get ahead of the rest of the economy. And so then we had inflation starting to rise, and then, of course, because of the oil shocks, when OPEC raised the price of oil twice during the 1970s,
uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Then you had this what we call the stagflation, where you had a combination of high inflation but also falling employment, falling output. And so you had people getting thrown out of work, but prices are still going up very fast.
Uh-huh.
So that was a really bad combination, and that was this big kind of what's going on type moment for economists. They said that we've never experienced this before. How do we get rid of this problem?
Well, how did they get rid of it?
Well, first they really had to tame the inflation, right? Because it turns out that the inflation was getting to be so high it was distorting people's decisions.
So what do you do to tame the inflation? What did they do? Was it the Federal Reserve Act?
Yeah, the Federal Reserve. So in the end of 1979, Jimmy Carter appointed Paul Volcker to be the chairman of the Fed.
Right. Uh-huh.
And Paul Volcker said, my number one job is to cut inflation and cut people's expectations of future inflation. And they did that by taking a very tight control of the money supply and really making sure that the money supply grew very slowly. And of course, when you do that, one of the bad consequences is that you cause a recession.
Sure,
of course, then we had the 82 recession, which was quite a bad recession.
Uh-huh.
In fact, before the financial crisis, the 1982 recession was the worst recession since the Great Depression.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
So
a lot of people were out of work. Industries couldn't produce at the level they would like to.
Exactly.
That type of thing.
Exactly. And so the problem with inflation is that once it gets into the economy, it's really hard to get it out, because what you have to do is you have to not only reduce inflation today, but you have to convince everybody in the economy that it's going to stay low in the future. That's the trick.
Uh-huh.
So once you get the inflation expectations high, getting inflation expectations to fall means that you have to hold inflation very low for a long time. That means basically you have to cause a recession.
Okay, but now we have had no inflation in this country for quite a while.
That's correct.
And even bumping the interest rates 0.25% isn't going to have much effect on that policy.
Not right now, but one of the things that the Fed is really concerned about is that if interest rates are really low, then if the economy really does fall into another recession in the future, the Fed needs to have what they call dry powder. They need to have some ability to stimulate the economy. And as we know, that the Fed's ability to stimulate the economy really comes from the ability to lower interest rates. So if you have interest rates that are really low, you really can't go any lower, so you can't do anything about it. Uh-huh. So part of what the Fed is trying to do is really simply to raise interest rates up to what we think is a normal level. And so if we get interest rates back to a normal level, if there is a recession, then the Fed can probably do something about it.
Yeah, yes. Does anybody define the normal level?
Well, most people think that a normal amount, a normal level of interest rates are somewhere in the, a short-term interest rate that's somewhere around the 3%, 4% range,
right? Yeah, that's what I thought, yeah.
You know, if you look at long-term averages, those seem to be a fairly average level for short-term interest rates. They've been higher, they've been lower, but somewhere around 3 to 4%.
A lot of things to talk about in economics. We're talking with Connie Fullenkamp, professor at Duke University, and we're covering only a segment of my list of things to talk to about today. One thing you study, in at least I read it in your biography, is immigrant remittances.
That's right.
What are immigrant remittances?
So remittances are monies that are sent from migrant workers back to their families. So when a person migrates to the U.S. from a place like Mexico or Brazil or the Middle East, they're usually migrating by themselves to get a job, and then they send some of their earnings back home to support their families. In fact, that's really one of the primary motivations of international migration, is for a family to send one of their members abroad where wages are higher and opportunities are better, so that they can earn money to send back home to support their family. And so these migrant remittances are individually very small. People are sending, $80, a couple hundred dollars at a time. But because there are so many migrant workers in the world, that they amount to hundreds of billions of dollars globally.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
We don't think about that at all.
We don't. And it's one of the reasons why I'm doing this research, is to try to draw more attention to it, because it's very large. The economic consequences of remittances are really quite surprising.
So what are the consequences?
Well, unfortunately, what we're finding is that remittances don't tend to stimulate the development of the economies that receive them. So you
do
think
not stimulate.
They don't.
People.
Yeah.
They
so
go back to the parents or the spouse or the family, and it doesn't do any good.
Well, we can't say that it doesn't do any good. Actually, they do a lot of good in terms of lifting people out of poverty.
The people that receive them.
Yeah, the people that receive the remittances have a big increase in their standard of living, which is great. But the problem is that does not translate into creating new businesses, creating new jobs, creating investment, and creating, a better economy for people at home. So that's been a big puzzle, because usually when you think of these big flows of money coming into a country, you think, gosh, that's got to be good for business, it's got to be good for the economy, it's got to be good for investment, and so on. And so one of the questions that we've been investigating in this research project, which goes back over a decade now for my involvement.
You're working with other people on
this. Yeah, I've been working with several people, including people at the IMF, who are also very interested in this. We've been trying to figure out why it is that remittances have not had a big positive impact in terms of economic development, even though they have a big anti-poverty effect, which is great.
Uh-huh.
Some of it is simply that, maybe we expect too much. Maybe all we're going to get is anti-poverty effect from remittances, and maybe expecting them to contribute to development is too much.
Well, aren't some of these countries that they're sending money to, particularly in Central America, somewhat corrupt? And could that have an impact on the value of what's been sending back?
It certainly could, and there's at least some evidence that the countries that receive more remittances tend to perpetuate having bad governments.
Yeah.
So the idea is that, if things are pretty bad in my country, but my brother in America is sending me money, then I don't care as much about how bad things are. So I don't try to improve the political process and things. So they have really, really interesting and very, very complex effects. And so, we can sit down and we can draw, make up a big list of all the positive things that remittances do for an economy and all the negative things. And it turns out they you know, for every positive effect, there's a negative effect. And so on net, they don't contribute to the development
but
like,
their
that, like
basic
they could.
Their basic motivation is to help the families that the money's being sent to.
Yes, yes.
And that's pretty much working.
That's working, exactly. So when we think about remittances, they're great for lifting people out of poverty. So there's no way that we should try to restrict the flow of remittances.
Yeah.
But we have looked at them and said, gosh, why don't they also help the economies develop? And that's the other part. That's the other piece that is missing, and that's the puzzle for us.
Are these remittances being sent to other countries from this U.S. government or this U.S. economy? Is that a political issue with us in this country? It isn't really, is it?
Well, it's a little bit of a political issue in the following sense. If remittances did help economies to grow and develop, then the politicians could say, you know, then there's no need for us to do any kind of foreign aid or other types of official government assistance, as we call it. So some people really want there to be, you know, want to find a positive effect of remittances on development so they can say, okay, remittances are fine. We don't need to send any foreign aid or foreign assistance in that way.
Uh-huh.
And certainly there, at least if you go back to the Bush administration, there was a big push in that direction to try to be a cheerleader and say, oh, remittances are great, so we don't need to spend as much money overseas. Not that we spend that much anyway, but that, you know, our research says that that's really not necessarily the case, that remittances don't help development, and so there still is a big role, especially in very narrow, you know, narrow sets of countries that are very, very poor for official, what we call official development aid.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, there's a lot to talk about, as I said several times. We've talked about immigrant remittances because every time I read your biography, I see that phrase and I think, what on earth is that? And thank you for the information.
Oh, sure. They're actually quite fascinating. And as you mentioned, you know, there are so many people who come to America to work. So
right.
America is a really big source globally of remittances.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. And these are not just Latin people from other countries too.
Oh, absolutely.
Asian
yeah.
countries. And,
yeah. yeah, from
and,
Asia, from the Middle East, from really from all over the world.
Uh-huh.
Although, you know, as you suggest, the predominant migrants come from nearby.
Uh-huh. Okay. Now, we have a new administration starting in a couple of weeks.
That's right.
And we can't talk about everything about that, but let's talk about trade for a minute.
Sure.
I think our president-elect says, let's get rid of all these trade degrees, deals we got, NAFTA,
mm-hmm.
and,
that's right.
And pay no attention to the Trans-Pacific deal.
Right.
And so what should we – trade is a major issue in the world economy.
Yeah, trade is a big deal, although really the really interesting fact is that in 2016, for the first time in post-war history, the level of global trade has actually fallen rather than rising. So there are several things going on, and part of it is that the backlash against international trade is not just an American phenomenon. It is also taking place in other developed countries that have experienced the same kinds of problems from trade that Americans have faced in terms of job losses. So it's really very interesting, but yes, global trade is still a really big deal and a big driving force in the global economy, but it's a really complex picture.
You probably discuss this at the International Monetary Fund events that you go to.
Trade is always a big part of the puzzle.
Uh-huh.
For all the developing countries, of course, because many of them are trying to be export-driven and trying to develop by promoting exports. So, yeah, this is always a big concern. And some of the countries that we routinely go to are countries that basically drive their economic policy completely off of trade.
Okay. So back on the issue of the overall trade, you say other countries in the developed world are seeing a reduction in trade because of job losses and things like that.
Yeah, so there's been a backlash.
Political problems.
Yeah, so there's been a backlash against trade, and so governments are more and more interested in putting some kinds of restrictions on trade. And so, you know, these tend not to be the tariffs and quotas that we saw in the past, They tend to be what we call non-tariff barriers, which are safety standards.
Oh,
they
yeah.
tend to be things like, you know, the Europeans don't want any foods with GMOs in them.
Right.
But those are all very effective at restricting trade, and they have kind of the same effect.
Uh-huh.
So in the name of things like safety and health, protecting intellectual property, protecting security, we're putting a lot of restrictions on trade these days.
Wow. It's 5:30, and we've only spent a half an hour with Connie Fullenkamp, and we got three more hours to go. But don't hang up, folks. Stay with us. You're listening to WCOM. This is your voice in the community. WCOM in Carrboro serves Carrboro and Chapel Hill on radio station 103.5 FM. We serve the world on WCOMFM.org, where people can listen to us elsewhere, and I hope some people are listening today. And you people who listen are the people who support this station. We are right here in Carrboro, and if you stop by and put a check in an envelope under the door, we will give you full credit for it, because we are a nonprofit organization, and every penny that comes into this station is a tax-deductible item for the person who makes the donation. You can go to our website and make a safe and secure donation to WCOM, WCOMFM.org, as I've mentioned, and we will be glad to receive your donation that way. We'll talk later on in the show about some organizations or people who actually underwrite specifically this show, Time Out. So we're thankful for the help that we get, and we want to continue to ask you for the help, because as a nonprofit, we don't have any employees. We are all volunteer, and we need the support to keep the lights on and to keep the station being listened to by those who pay attention to us. Okay, Connie, where are we? Trade. We are facing a new administration with questions, because there's nothing specific has been said about what might be happening.
Well, and many of the things that have been said are really hard to see how they'd be implemented. So staying on the subject of trade for a moment,
yeah.
You know, the president-elect has talked about dismantling or modifying a lot of our trade agreements.
Right.
But I think he's forgotten that it's been, you know, literally 20 years plus that we've had NAFTA, for
right.
example. And entire industries have reorganized themselves to take advantage of NAFTA. And what happens now is that when something is built, they build a little bit of it in Mexico, they ship it across the border to Texas, where a little bit more is built on, then it goes back across the border to Mexico, they modify it a little bit and ship it back to the U.S., and this goes on back and forth several times.
Is that happening?
Yeah, that is the new reality in what
okay.
we call the global supply chain.
Uh-huh.
And, excuse me, to dismantle the trade agreements would throw a big monkey wrench in that. It would take a long time to sort that out. And so I don't think a lot of businesses would be all that happy about kind of walking away from NAFTA very suddenly. I mean, certainly, as with any kind of an international agreement, it's something that you could probably modify and improve. But to say that we're going to dismantle NAFTA overnight is really it really flies in the face of the kind of the economic reality, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that make me think that for all the bluster and the tough talk, I think once we get down to the specifics about what reality actually is and what you'd have to do to change some of these agreements, I think we'll see the administration dropping that or moving on to something else.
Well, what about the administration or the implementation of a new agreement like the Trans-Pacific Agreement, which has been agreed to by many Asian countries? About how many, 15, 20 countries have agreed to that, and we have not yet.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, I think one of the consequences of the election, as we saw, was that Barack Obama decided, frankly, just to drop pushing for it. He didn't even try to bring it to
right.
a vote in Congress once the election was held. That's unfortunate for a couple of reasons. Number one is that for all of its flaws, the Trans-Pacific Partnership had a lot of intellectual property protections that would have been really good for American industries and American businesses that do a lot of exporting. The other thing is that the other unfortunate thing is that now China has stepped into the role of the trade deal maker.
Okay,
we're
being pushed to the side.
Yeah, at least in terms of – it's one way that the Chinese are trying to kind of elbow the U.S. out of the way and reestablish their dominance in the Pacific region.
Well, it's really hard to see that China will not be dominant in the, because they're right there. They're surrounded by all these smaller countries. And anyway, that's their universe.
Well, absolutely. I think, you know, I don't think anybody should say that China should not play a leading role either in the regional economy or in the global economy because they're such a large economy. I think that the question is whether we're going to kind of cede total control or total influence to China.
Well, why shouldn't we be trying to work with China?
I think that we should be. I think it's a matter of whether how much space there is for the countries to work together. I think.
Well, at least we could work together in an attitude without necessarily working, but we can talk about it in a positive vein.
Well, I think so. It really depends on the attitudes of the leaders toward what their own goals are. If you look at what's going on in China, we're thinking about the leaders who are really interested in consolidating power and control right now, and increasing influence not only internationally but also domestically. If you've looked at how hard the Chinese government has cracked down on internal dissent and in terms of security, I think you know it's clear that they're not necessarily that interested right now in cooperating with the U.S. that much. I don't think that there's a lot of support in the U.S. on our side for cooperating with China that much these days. But you're right. I mean, it boils down to this attitude. I don't think it's there right now.
Attitude, if the attitude is positive, even though nothing's happening, at least the door would be open.
Yeah, I remember when, for example, when Gorbachev came to power in the Soviet Union, one of the big pronouncements was made by Margaret Thatcher, who had a conversation with him. I don't know if it was a state visit or something, but she came back and said to the rest of the West, she said, "This is a man we can do business with."
Uh-huh, right.
And that helped to promote better relations between the Soviet Union and the West, at least for
that's kind of what Trump says about Putin.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll see where that leads.
Yeah, right.
It's not totally clear to me what the U.S. has to gain from better relations with Russia.
Wouldn't it be better to have at least flat relations as opposed to negative relations?
Yeah, as opposed to adversarial relations, certainly on the political sphere. I guess I was thinking more about economically. I'm not sure what the economic advantage is for the U.S. Certainly, the Russians have a lot to gain in terms of access to goods and services, and also to kind of have a better market for their oil and other natural resources. And they're still a very heavily natural resource dependent economy.
From what I read, the Russian economy is in pretty bad shape.
Yeah, indeed, and that's
what is that, inflation, or what is it, just a lack of activity, or the oil prices down?
Yeah, certainly, as I said, they're still heavily dependent on natural resources, and since many of the prices have been depressed in the last several years, that's had a big negative impact on the Russian economy. And as you suggest, you know, they aren't the most well-administered economy in the world.
Okay. Well, okay, on and on and on. How about the aspect of jobs and technology in this country, particularly in the manufacturing of products that can be done through robots and other technical, as opposed to people standing here with wrenches and hammers?
Yeah, I think you hit on a really big and fascinating subject, and one that is actually very closely related to trade. And in fact, people have been complaining a lot about the effects of trade on jobs and job losses, when many economists who have studied this say, you know, the big culprit is not really, or not as much as you think, as moving jobs overseas, is replacing humans with machines of various kinds, including just computers. Mm-hmm. So I think that is going to be a big issue that we're going to struggle more and more with as we go into the future.
Well, and that's going to affect not just the manufacturing, but it'll affect white collar jobs.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, you know, even in my own job of teaching, we're seeing, you know, people using an increased amount of technology, and in some cases with the hopes of replacing, you know, live physical professors with video or with other types of computerized learning tools. So, yeah, I think we're all looking to a future where more and more kind of human jobs are replaced by automation of some kind.
Well, that's interesting, because a lot of these things have their cycles.
That's right.
And we're talking about the cycle which we're talking about now, where humans are replaced by non-humans. And it would seem to me that maybe 30, 40, 50 years down the road, that might be reversed by the need for humans in an element that they've been pushed out of.
Well, I think
if we're going to have people, we've got to keep them working somehow.
Well, I think you're right. The question is, how can we keep people productively employed in the types of jobs that really are worth doing?
Uh-huh.
I mean, one of the reasons why I like my work is because it's really fulfilling. I'm not sure, if we lose manufacturing jobs where your job is just to tighten this screw on this device over and over again for 8 hours a day, 7 days a week, I'm not sure you lose that job. It's really, that's such a big loss to society, right? What we wanted to have is people doing jobs that are fulfilling.
But you're going to replace that with a job that means something to you.
Yeah, exactly. But I think one of the things we've fallen down in our society is that the economy has moved on, and the jobs are being created at these very high levels, but our educational system has not picked up the slack and helped people prepare and get themselves ready to take on jobs that will be much more satisfying and fulfilling.
So where does our educational system have to move to fulfill these opportunities?
Well,
not at Duke University.
Well, but at Duke, I'm teaching the students who are basically the winners in the current system. The kids I'm teaching are smart, they're bright, they're motivated, they've succeeded in the traditional education that we have, and so they're fine. The people we've
well,
really
they're fine,
failed.
But they have to find something to do when they leave your arms.
Yeah, and the vast majority of them go on to really great jobs.
Okay.
Right, in all kinds of different fields, for-profit, non-for-profit, all kinds of stuff. So the students at Duke are really, by and large, are extremely well off, and they're getting these really, really great jobs that really can lead to very fulfilling careers.
Yeah.
In my mind, the people that we're leaving behind are the people who are not making it in our current educational system. They're dropping out, or they're getting a substandard education that isn't preparing them for a decent job, or for a job that will support them. And somehow we need to replace our current system or augment it with a system that will work for other types of learners.
It seems to me that sometimes our community colleges have helped in that regard.
Certainly, and I really think that pouring more resources into places like community college to make them more responsive to the job market, and to help people who are not being well served by other traditional means of education is a great idea. I think we need to focus more on the outcomes of individual learners rather than this kind of calendar-based system where we have, you're 10 years old, so you're going to be in the fourth grade this year, and then you're going to move to the fifth grade, et cetera,
uh-huh.
and so on.
Uh-huh.
I think that works well for a lot of kids, but it doesn't work for everybody.
Uh-huh.
And we need to step back and, for many people, personalize the educational process, think about people achieving educational goals and acquiring skills rather than just saying, you pass this test or something. We really want to focus on what people know, keeping them motivated to continue learning and continue developing themselves.
So that requires universities like you to help develop the people that you are saying are needed to help this educational process grow.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I mean, you can't just teach, as you say, just teach smart kids that get big jobs. You have to, you the university, has
right.
to provide educational avenues so people can learn to help people find good jobs.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think there are a lot of initiatives going on like that at Duke. They've got a really good program in education. They've
Do
got
they?
People in psychology working on that. Yeah, they've so those are definitely some of the areas. There's a really interesting initiative at Duke called Bass Connections, and one of these
called
is
what?
Bass Connections.
It's B-A-S-S?
Yeah, B-A-S-S, after the Bass family that donated the money to fund this
uh-huh.
initiative, but it has many interdisciplinary projects, and one of them has a basic theme of human development. And so they look at different educational outcomes, they look at different ways to be creative with education. So there are lots of initiatives at Duke and many other universities that are really trying to crack this nut, because it's pretty tough.
Uh-huh.
And I think that what we're going to find is that we need to have a whole portfolio of different ways of educating people that work for different folks.
Okay. Well, we're talking with Connie Fullenkamp. We have a few more minutes to wrap up this whole world of economics in a nutshell. The phone is open, 949-919-246-9639. If you call, make sure it's an intelligent question, because we don't want any people like me calling in with dumb questions. Anyway, Connie, what about back to the federal government again? And creating money. What about this huge federal deficit? Where And with the fact that our president-elect wants to do all these things, build all new, do a lot of infrastructure, which costs money.
Right.
And he also wants to cut taxes, which reduces
also costs money.
So that's not going to work. But what about the overall federal deficit as it continues to increase and people overseas own our country?
Yeah,
by owning our bonds.
Well, I think that's really going to be a pressing issue as we go forward, because as we know, what the incoming Trump administration has promised is a lot more spending of various kinds, tax cuts, on top of a situation in which we already know that some of our big social spending programs like Medicare and Social Security are on their way to going broke. So we have a really huge potential problem with government spending that we really need to get under control, and it's not clear to me at all that the incoming administration has any concept of how to deal with that. So we are going to have to worry about how to deal with government spending and how to put our long-term finances on a good footing.
Well, the big expenses in the federal government are Medicare, Medicaid, and defense.
Yeah, basically. Basically.
And Medicare, which I'm on, I've been extremely happy with it. All kinds of expenses that I might have had or my wife might have had are reduced to basically almost nothing because the federal government is behind this.
So it's clear that this program is not going to go away, right? So the answer is not going to be let's cut Medicare or let's cut Social Security. The answer is going to be let's try to keep their growth let's keep them growing at a slower level, and let's try to find better ways of paying for them in the long run.
But people like you 20 years ago had said the same thing.
Yeah, isn't it crazy that I remember when I was in high school that they convened a special commission to try to rescue Social Security,
right?
And they ended up phasing in this increase in the retirement age so that my generation, my cohort will retire not at 65, but at 67, for example, or 70 or something like that. So, yes, so this is a recurring problem. And as our society ages, which it's doing, it's just going to get worse. And as our birth rates continue to fall, which they're doing, going to continue to get worse.
Right.
So, yeah, these are issues that all developed countries are facing, both in the U.S. and Europe.
Real problems. Some
European countries are having very dire problems. Of course, the worst is Japan.
Yeah, right.
And of course, people talk about China as the next country because they restricted their birth rate so severely for so long that they say that China is going to get old before it gets rich.
And China has a lot of single men and no women to match with.
Exactly, and a very low population growth rate.
Well, have people done studies of the worst possibility or the medium-sized possibility or the best possibility to overcome these issues you're talking about, like the declining birth rates and all the other issues to go with it?
Well, I think they have. I think the results are all pretty grim across the board. The one thing that is a pretty sure fix for this that most countries don't want to hear about is basically immigration. So if you allow more immigration into your country, immigrants tend to be younger, they tend to work, they tend to have a lot of kids, and so they help push back up the growth rate of the population,
which is happening somewhat in this country.
Somewhat, but I mean that if it weren't for immigration, I will say that our population growth rate would be even lower.
Yeah.
So it's not that we have a population explosion in the U.S., but our population growth rate would be a lot lower without immigration.
Of course, immigration in some countries, like because of the tremendous people leaving Syria and those parts of the country, going into Europe have been not necessarily productive because they have to get settled first.
And you're exactly right. That's a huge logistical and economic problem that you take in all kinds of asylum seekers and refugees.
Yeah.
And you have to have a system to try to integrate people into the society and help them find jobs, and that's not necessarily easy.
No, it's hard and it's expensive.
Oh, absolutely.
And it creates a lot of nervousness on the part of the people who are already the residents, the natives of the countries.
Yeah, I think we've talked about this a bit in the past, but I just want to repeat that we basically have open trade and capital. You know, we have open trade in goods and services, but we do not have open trade in labor. Uh-huh. And so one of the things that we could do to remedy this is to have a better system of what I would call temporary migration into countries, including the U.S., where we let people in, you know, explicitly on a temporary basis. They do it all legally, and it's much more it's much easier, but also much more controlled, instead of having kind of illegal immigration.
Well, how would you do that? Temporary immigration from like a group of people from Syria?
Yeah, they could apply. You know, it's basically a process. You could have a formalized process in which they apply to come in and work in the U.S. So some countries like Canada, for example, take a bunch of data about you, and they give you a score based on your education and your age and things like that. If your score is high enough, then they'll offer you, you know, they'll say it's okay for you to migrate into Canada. I mean, there are lots of different ways that we could run a system like that and give people, say, okay, you have 3 years where you can come and work in a job in the U.S. and then you can reapply or something like that. Or maybe it's only a one-shot deal where you get 3 years and you have to go home. But it'd still be a lot easier and better than having people trying to risk their lives and come into the U.S. illegally.
That's true. And you mentioned Canada, because Canada seems to have a little more smooth immigration policy than we do.
They have had in the past, yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So there are just simply different ways to handle that. And I think that, you know, I think it would be foolish to say that the U.S. has not benefited from the migration that we've had. I mean, you know, the country was built on migrants, and
that's right.
If you look at, you know, what migrants contribute today, they actually contribute a whole lot. And so everybody needs to come to terms with that and say, okay, what kind of a role can we do? Are they going to play, and can we make that, you know, as beneficial for everybody as possible, including, you know, having people come to the U.S., work hard, pay taxes, and, you know, get the benefits that come along with that, and the rest of the society gets the benefits from having productive citizens who pay taxes and want to contribute.
It sounds like a good possibility, and we need people in the government who think about these things. So you guys are professors. I don't know whether your programs are. I mean, some of you work off and on with the government. I mean, you work with International Monetary Fund, so you're working with a lot of governments. But are people in the academic world making themselves heard in our government?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are. I think, as you point out, we tend to play. We tend to be role players. We tend to give a little bits of advice on fairly specific issues.
Yeah.
Once in a while, you get academics who move up into very influential positions. For example, you know, the leading kind of economist position would be the chair of the Council of Economic Advisors for the president.
Uh-huh.
That can be a very influential position. Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. But it's definitely, you know, since we're academics, we all have our own small areas of expertise, and we usually do best by staying inside those areas of expertise and not wandering too far outside those boundaries.
Well, you have three young children. What do you look for when they're your age? What kind of a country will they be living in when they are in the level of age that you are, you and Karen?
Yeah, well, I certainly hope by that time that they will have that they'll all have, you know, careers and jobs that they think are really fulfilling and beneficial to them. As we've talked about, that's one of the things I worry about the most, that that young people are able to acquire the skills that they need and match up with professions that are going to suit them. And as you say, that's far enough ahead in the future where I'm not really sure what kinds of opportunities there will be. You know, in historically, as technology has improved, it's also improved the job prospects, and it's created new jobs for people. And it's not necessarily true that that's going to continue to happen.
Uh-huh.
It's not necessarily true that as technology continues to improve, it'll create new jobs for people.
Uh-huh.
So I really honestly don't know what to think about this. Some people say the same stuff will happen again, and we'll have new types of jobs. I'm not sure. I just don't know.
Well, it's your job. It's your role in life to make sure that this happens for your children. It's my role in life to be talking to people like you to get the word out that we need to get going on this.
That's right.
I'd like to tell you that this program is supported by several underwriters, one of whom we will probably have on the show in a few months, Michael Cotter, retired Ambassador Michael Cotter. You'd be interested in talking with him, Connie. He lives in the area, and he was in the Foreign Service for his entire career, and his last job before I retired was ambassador to the country of Turkmenistan. But Mike's been on the show probably 10 or 12 times and loves to talk about issues, particularly Middle Eastern things.
Oh, sure.
And he travels a lot. He has been traveling a lot, and he's been a great supporter of the station. And he's an underwriter of this show. Another underwriter is the Triangle Association of Health Underwriters. These are people who are knowledgeable in the field of health insurance and can help you work your way through the difficulties of Obamacare if you need to buy health insurance for yourself or your family. Another of our underwriters is Tim Hucks. He is the CEP of Rising Tide. Rising Tide and Tim are more than financial advisors. They're true friends, and you can count on them through good and bad times. And I always like to acknowledge an underwriter who says, right down the street, who lives here in this lovely town of Carver, who says she will support community radio until the end of time. And that's gonna go right past me. And next week, we're at Duke again. And next week, I consider this to be a very interesting possibility for this station. We're going to be talking with women's golf coach Dan Brooks. The women's golf team in Duke has had fantastic careers and results with Dan. He's been here 30-some years.
Yeah, and I'll
you
say—
You know him?
I don't know him, but I've certainly had a number of his golfers in my classes, and I will say that they are just as good academically as they are on the links. So, yeah, so that's a great program.
I was so lucky to have him willing to talk to us, and I said, bring one of your ladies along. Two of his stalwarts right now, one is McGuire, I think her name is. She's from Ireland, and another one is Virginia Carta. She's from Italy, and both of them won championships. Virginia Carta won the NCAA Women's Golf Championship last year as a freshman.
Wow.
Amazing.
Incredible.
And she roomed right next door to my granddaughter, and who said that Virginia helped her learn Italian during their freshman year together. So that's it for today, folks. You are so great to take time to come over here and talk to us, Sakani. It's really it's just so stimulating to get into these issues.
Well, thanks. I really enjoy it, Bill.
And have a great year. And
we'll
maybe talk in the summertime after the administration has been in bed for a while to see how they're doing.
Yeah, once we find out some specifics from these guys, huh?
Right. Okay, that's it, folks. Talk to you next Monday with Coach Dan Brooks.